Good afternoon, everyone. It's May 23rd, 2011. Monday, it's 3 p.m., well, like 3:10 p.m. Welcome to Hearing Room E and Rules. Going to start by just sharing a few things here at the very beginning. House Bill 2492 will not be considered today. For those of you who are here for that bill, Senate Bill 248 will be moved to May 25th. And I think that I think Mr. Stembridge, that says it.
You say you're not going to open it.
What do you want to do? Do you want to open it up?
Yeah. I was supposed to be open up, give a chance to amend it and carry it over.
Do you want to grab him really quick then? Before you...
You might want to say we're reconsidering 248.
If you want to stand fast, we're going to reconsider and actually open up a work session on Senate Bill 248 to listen to the Dash 2 amendments.
I think the senator just...
When he heard it, I need to carry it over.
Pardon me?
We're trying to catch him.
Yeah, if we can catch him.
I need to run up to my office.
Did somebody go to catch him?
Is somebody jumping up or...
I'm not moving.
Can I get him back?
I'm all in.
It's fire drill.
Fake out.
Is Senator Hass the only one that could explain those amendments? Or is there
I think so. Quickest.
You have the copies.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Did somebody really get it? I couldn't tell.
Did you send somebody to get it?
Jim, he's here. Okay, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 248. And Senator Hass, if you want to make your way on up here. And then, Jim, if you'd kind of want to share a little bit with us. What we're looking at.
Victoria Cox is our staff person on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 248 in its original form requires school districts to offer full-day kindergarten beginning with 2015-2016 school year. Extends requirements school districts offer half-day kindergarten through the 2014-2015 school year. Changes the state school fund distribution formula to a full weight for each enrolled kindergarten student, commencing with the 2015-2016 distribution.
Thank you.
Hello, Senator Hass. How you doing?
Doing fine.
Thanks for coming back.
Senator Holson. Thank you for having me back. Mark Hass, Senate District 14. Things haven't changed much since we talked last. There is an amendment that you probably are just reading for the first time, the Dash 2s. I met with Representative Johnson and with his experience as a school board member, we talked about the idea of making this kindergarten requirement permissive. So if you're a school district and for whatever reason you're not ready, don't have the space or whatever, this need not apply to you until you opt in, as it were. And I'm very supportive of this amendment, and I think it improves the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to speak to the Dash 2 amendments? All right. Good. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 248, and we'll move that bill to Wednesday, May 25th. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3659.
That was special. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3659 requires administrative rules adopted by Department of Human Services on qualifications of persons for board membership of a DHS regulated or DHS contracted entity directly impact the safety and welfare of children serviced by the entity. It prohibits DHS administrative rules that impose an undue burden on unnecessary paperwork on such an entity. It applies the provisions to the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Youth Authority, in addition to DHS, directs DHS, the Oregon Health Authority, and the Oregon Youth Authority to conduct studies of the regulation and oversight of children's programs to reduce duplication and improve efficiency and cost savings, and to submit the report to an interim Human Services Legislative Committee by December 1, 2011. It authorizes children's programs to submit proposals to the agencies to simplify audits, reviews, reports, or licensing requirements.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Michael Dembro, State Representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose. Thank you for hearing this bill. 3659 comes to you with the partnership of Representative John Huffman, who's here. If I fall flat on my face, he will come up and he will steer you straight. This is a bill that had its this is a bill that had its roots back in 2009 when Representative Huffman and I were both on the Human Services Committee. At that time, we were considering a bill, House Bill 2990, that would have allowed DHS to charge a licensing fee on residential care providers in order to allow them to do more extensive oversight of some of the problem facilities that were out there with respect to children's residential facilities. When the bill had its public hearing at that time, we heard opposition from several of the top care providers in the state who objected to having their costs increased in a tough economic time to pay for more oversight when they were doing everything right. They acknowledged that there were bad apples out there, but they were doing everything right, and they were going to be required to pay a licensing fee to cover those bad apples. What they argued in that hearing was that if they could be released from some of the duplicative site visits and reports to which they were subject, that could free up existing DHS personnel to do more oversight of the bad apples. They were subject to oversight from the county, from the feds, from their professional organizations, as well as from the state. And they wondered why they all needed to do that every year, given that the findings for them were always positive. It was a point that resonated with me, and I think it resonated with Representative Huffman. We started talking about looking into this, and one thing led to the next, and that next is this bill, 3659. During the interim, we met with advocates and with DHS and learned from the newly hired executive director of Morrison Family Services that the state of Washington, where she had worked previously, had done some interesting things to reduce overlap and duplication with respect to some of the time-consuming and expensive audits and reports that they had to do with no negative outcomes. She was very interested in seeing us pursue Washington's lead. We learned from DHS that they, too, are interested in pursuing efficiencies and have been convening work groups to help with that. We learned from the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs that there were a couple of related issues that were embedded in bills introduced last session that didn't move forward. In the end, we worked with the Alliance to bring all these concerns together in the form of the bill that's before you today. I feel confident that members of the committee will agree with the goal of eliminating duplication, allowing DHS workers to put a priority on the situations that put kids at risk, and reducing overhead costs for the nonprofit providers so that they can put more resources into direct services that help kids. At the same time, obviously, we don't want to cut back on oversight that is really needed and that would really make a difference in terms of safety and effectiveness. It's a delicate balance that we need to strike. I believe that all the parties want to see positive changes happen. I think we would all agree that the bill in its current form is a work in progress, and the departments and the providers are willing to work with Representative Huffman and me to amend the language so it addresses core targeted concerns and allows for continued work towards efficiency and regulatory reform for providers, while avoiding unintended administrative burdens on both children's providers and government agencies. It's a great effort and an important one. We convened a group today at lunchtime, started talking about where we might move the bill, in terms of taking some things out, clarifying other things, and you'll hear more about that. But I'd like now to, certainly I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I also have with me Janet Ahrens from the Alliance for Children's Programs, and she can go more into some of the concerns that led to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Janet?
Thank you. I'm Janet Ahrens, Executive Director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I want to thank Representatives Dumbrow and Huffman for their work on this bill. They've been thinking about this since last session and have put quite a lot of thought into it, have talked to a lot of people, and have represented well the issues and the concerns that we face. I also appreciate the Rules Committee taking a few minutes out for us. The Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs is a statewide nonprofit association of other nonprofit providers. We represent about $180 million worth of services, 7,000 employees, 95,000 kids. And these are these programs range from mentoring programs all the way into high-end psychiatric residential. So we run the gamut of the kinds of kids that we see. That gives us a unique perspective because one organization might provide mental health services to kids who've been abused and neglected, and so there's two or three different state agencies you might have contracts with. So the vortex of where regulations intersect is really inside our organizations. So that perspective has given us both some unique opportunities to work collaboratively with state agencies and also an opportunity to be able to see where streamlining and redundancies occur and where we might be able to do things a little more efficiently. Attached to the packet that I gave you are letters from about 16 or so nonprofits who are commenting on support for the bill and their reason, what the impact of the regulation is on them, and also providing a couple of ideas and concepts that could be moved forward and negotiated. And a few of you have received letters independent from this packet as well. This is especially earnest as budget reductions come, so we also need to have administrative reductions come along. This is that opportunity. If you'll turn to the third page, there's a color. It says current duplicative oversight process. There's a color graph. This is from my colleague in North Carolina. They have a system that has providers contracting with multiple different kinds of agencies and different service sectors. And what they hired a firm to come in and map what the oversight looks like. And then they mapped, if you'll turn to the next page, the outcome that they wanted in working with legislation. They just passed, I just talked to my colleague this morning on the phone, and they have passed legislation in North Carolina to achieve the streamlined oversight process. So we see this bill as the vehicle for us to achieve that. The other issue with the reporting and the auditing and oversight is in licensing, particularly in the area of governance. I also attached a copy of the Oregon Administrative Rules for governance if you'd like to be licensed by DHS to provide services. And our concerns are, again, there's a theme here of redundancy. Many of the regulations and requirements, I'm sure some of these are not currently big hammers in the audits that they do with agencies, like you have to have a list of your board of directors and contact information for them. Although in rule and in statute, they can close down an agency for a violation of the rules. We think some of this could be easily cleaned up the focus of the rules really, one of the concerns that my members have is that it tells you what your executive director must look like, what their characteristics are, how often you review them. It has some pretty definitive information in here oversight in here that we think for private corporations in Oregon that have lots and lots of risk and lots of responsibility that some of this is replicative of other requirements of federal law, state law. If you look at the index for the state statutes, take a look at governance and nonprofit organizations. The index alone is 11 pages, and then you go into the actual statutes. So we're sure there's some opportunity to do a little cleanup here. We're also a little bit concerned about whether or not the rules for licensing veer off of the number one priority, which is really child safety, and whether or not there's an opportunity here to take a look at bringing rules, particularly around governance of private corporations, in line with our number one priority. DHS and the other state agencies who are affected by this. There's no question that they have been doing work and that they have been working with us and that there has been progress made. It's a big ship, and there's a lot of opportunities here to continue that work and continue the momentum of some of it that got started with Representatives Dembrow and Huffman last session. And we're really looking forward to bringing some ideas and seeing what we can get done in the next 6 months.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair. Do we have a definition of child safety?
It was my understanding in Chair Olson and Representative Barnhart, it was my understanding when I spoke with the department and asked them this question that the rules themselves, if I define it correctly, the rules themselves stand as the definition, that there is no target definition. In other words, the definition says here's what child safety is, and then you evaluate the rules and connect it to the target definition. So we would love to see something like that.
A slightly different topic, if I may. I got the impression from Representative Dembrow that the bill isn't ready. And that being the case, this is a very complex topic. I think everybody certainly can agree. I assume our chart isn't a whole lot different from the one from North Carolina. I mean, the details are obviously different, but in terms of complexity. Do you think that you can actually tear this subject apart and put back together in a way more like the second chart between now and the end of the session? Or is this something that really requires some careful interim study to get it done?
Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart, I think the latter. I think it's going to take a little bit of work, and there's a lot at stake for the state agencies as well as for the provider community and other Oregonians. We need to stay focused on some of the bigger picture in session right now, but absolutely getting together as soon as session's over and people can catch their breath to work on this. I think it's very, very important that it be done because it really represents savings on both sides.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. If I may, the complexities can get mind-boggling, and of course, the legislatures meet and they see a problem and they pass a bill and they add another line to the chart. Nobody's at fault for that, but every once in a while, you got to go along and clean out the cobwebs so that there are fewer lines. It is very difficult and complicated to do that. However, the little bit I've done trying to work on different areas than this one, but to get the same results, demonstrate the mind-boggling nature of this thing. I wish you luck. I will certainly support the results if you manage to pull it off.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may add, Representative Barnhart, you're absolutely right. And that's really what this bill is about. It's initiating the process for cutting through those cobwebs. There's another bill that's out there that the House passed a month or so ago, and I think it's before the Senate now, House Bill 2856, which is doing something similar, which is also, it's an effort to cut through some of these cobwebs, and it's also looking at the county and the relationship between state oversight and county oversight, and to trying to bring them into greater alignment. So I don't think anyone would pretend that we could amend this bill to solve the problem, but it's to amend it in a way that will, you know, create the, that will initiate the work, substantial as it is, that's needed to really make progress on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final comment then. A much less ambitious topic. Let's see if we can't get it through here this year. It would be great if we could. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Representative Huffman, do you plan on sharing anything, or
you lost
you just
chance,
back?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Right. Anybody else like to testify regarding? Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3659. I am going to, let's see, is Jim Willis. Are you going to, okay. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3661.
You need to open the public hearing on 3661.
What did I say? Possibly. Work session?
Yeah, you want, okay. You've got... possible session. You want to open it just for the public hearing.
Okay. Correction on House Bill 3661. This is a public hearing.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3661 regulates the activities of persons who prepare, present, or prosecute veterans' benefits claims. It requires such persons to be recognized as agents or attorneys under specific federal law. It prohibits an agent or attorney from requiring veterans to transfer assets in exchange for filing the claims. It limits the fees to 20% of past due benefit amounts obtained. It requires claims on behalf of Oregon residents to be filed in Oregon. It declares an emergency effective September 1st, 2011. You have your fiscal and revenue offices both say no impact.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I apologize that Director Willis is not with us. He is detained in a meeting with the governor. House Bill 3661 is a loaded bill, and I apologize for that as well. We just learned as a department that this was a consumer protection issue that we need to take care of. World War II veteran Sam Special called our office about 3.5-4 weeks ago, and he said that in his retirement home, an organization, a business had come in to talk about all these wonderful veteran benefits he was going to get. In fact, they were promising Sam up to $3,000 a month if he could apply for what we call pension with aid and attendance. The problem with Sam was he was over income for that VA benefit, but the business said, if you just sign over your assets to us, we would happily file this claim for you and get you this great VA benefit, pension with aid and attendance. Well, we've been aware for many, many years that there are companies out there talking to residential facilities, retirement homes, nursing homes, and what they do is they contact the home, and for a fee, they say they'll talk to these veterans and get them benefits. The implication is there'll be more money than to pay for the home, to pay for the veterans' care. And then they go to the veteran and they promise the veteran that they're going to get this great benefit, pension with aid and attendance, and they're going to get between $2,500 and $3,000 a month in new income. So you can see that there's an issue there. Now, under 38 U.S.C. Chapter 59, which is the federal law on veterans statutes, agents and attorneys recently were given the authority to do certain things under the law. They're allowed to file claims on behalf of veterans. Under Chapter 59 and 38 U.S.C., they're only allowed, though, to take 20% of a veteran's initial compensation award. And how that works is if I file a claim for myself, it could be up to a year, year and a half before my claim actually gets decided. There's going to be a retro check because the claim starts the day I file it. So this check comes in, and what the attorney or the agent gets is 20% of that retro amount. That's all legal. We have no problem with that. We actually have no problems with the attorneys and agents doing any of the work that's allowed by law. Where we run into a little bit of an issue is the issue of trying to tell a veteran that they have to sign over their assets. That was a new one. We hadn't heard that until Mr. Special had called us. We think that is questionable ethically. We're not sure it's legal because what you're doing is saying a veteran who has assets really doesn't, so he's going to get this benefit by signing over the assets. House Bill 3661 tries to do a couple things. One, it takes language from 38 U.S.C. Chapter 59 and sticks it in our law, so it defines what an agent is, what an attorney can do under the federal law. But it does three specific things. It says you can't promise a veteran they're going to get a benefit. I'm an accredited veteran service officer. I do claims work for veterans. I'm not allowed to tell a veteran that they're going to get the benefit. I can tell them they're eligible, but I can't make the guarantee because I'm not the federal government giving the benefit. The second thing the bill does is it requires a veteran, it makes sure that there's no requirement for a veteran to turn over assets to have a claim done. We think that's just insidious and should be an unlawful trade practice. Third, and this is a unique one, these companies aren't Oregon companies that are targeting our senior veterans. A lot of the companies are out of state, and what they'll do is they'll contract with an attorney or an agent in the state of Oregon, and when they do the work, they actually file the claim in Denver or New Jersey or Florida, and Oregon has no visibility over that claim. We have no idea the veteran's been serviced. So what we're asking is that the claims for Oregon veterans be filed with the regional office in Portland for Oregon veterans. I will tell you that's not unusual. As a veteran service officer in Oregon, I can file claims for Oregonians in Oregon, but if there's a Washington veteran, I can't file that claim in Oregon for a Washington veteran. I'm not allowed to do that. I have to file in Seattle at the Washington State's regional office there. So we think that HB 3661 is a consumer protection bill. It doesn't prohibit the businesses from contacting these facilities, charging the fee, talking to the veteran, or filing the claim. It allows them to do their business. And I will tell you, as someone who's owned two businesses, I would never want to put any kind of regulations over restricting someone from doing business. But what we want to do is put some guardrails up, saying that when you start promising things that aren't yours to promise, when you start taking assets from people as the reason you're going to do their claim, and you're filing claims that no one has visibility on, that goes outside those guardrails. And that's what 3661 does. It just puts these guardrails up for these companies. And we're hopeful that that will be something that those companies can work with and do the job the way it should be done in Oregon. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Winger.
Jim, should the bill pass and a person is in violation of one of those three, what's the remedy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winger, what we have done is put this under the statutes of the unlawful trade practices. At that point, the Attorney General's office can be contacted to ask nicely that they come into compliance, and if they refuse to come into compliance with Oregon law, they can take those civil actions.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this create a new regulatory authority, or is it just a statutory prohibition on certain conduct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, I believe it's just a statutory prohibition.
Okay.
It does not create a new regulation. And the reason I say that is last session we passed legislation under these same statutes dealing with USERRA and the Servicemen's Civil Rights Act that both went underneath these same statutes for veterans, ensuring that if you were deployed and there were unlawful trade practices while you were deployed that are still federal statutes, that they were in Oregon statutes as well. So we're trying to follow the same model as the legislature used last session.
Follow up.
Well, it just occurs to me, since this seems to be a new problem, I'm sure a lot of thought has gone into the drafting of it, but since it's a new problem, you might not yet have encountered everything you'd like to try to prevent. And so I wonder if, you know, we've written this very specifically, but it may end up being off the mark. You know, it's sometimes when you create a specific prohibition, you create a roadmap for the people who are trying to get around it. So is there something to be said for maybe giving you a little more flexibility here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, that is an excellent comment. And among us staff, we've talked about the very same thing, saying, well, we put this in there and they'll probably find a way around it and we'll be back before the legislature. The question we had as we talked this out with counsel and the DOJ was exactly what could we say that would get to these practices in such a general form but still allow them to practice under the federal USC. So we decided just to take a swipe at the three things we know they're doing and start with that.
Just for example, Mr. Chair, I mean, it says that an agent or attorney may not, quote, promise, end quote, that a veteran will receive a benefit, but that wouldn't stop an agent from saying an awful lot of potentially misleading things. So,
absolutely.
Just pointing that out.
No, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Hey, anyone else? Okay.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Tom. Anybody else like to speak on House Bill 3661? So we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3661 and open up a work session on House Bill 3661.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3661 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves House Bill 3661 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Wingert.
Chair, I'd simply point out that when a bill like this is created that adds something to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the bill itself contains the entire list, and that starts on page 1 with A, moves through the entire alphabet, and then goes to AA, and then moves through the entire alphabet until it becomes AAA. And I believe what we are adding with this bill will be RRR, full employment for attorneys. I realize some of them may be here on the dais.
Mr. Chair.
R.
Mr. Chair, yes. It's a shame that people have found so many ways to cheat and defraud good Oregonians over time.
Thank you, Representative Wingert, for pointing that out. Remember me at Christmas.
We need a larger alphabet.
Mr. Chair. Okay, is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support the motion, but I want to note that as Representative Garrett, I think, pointed out there, this is the beginning of the subject rather than the end of it. I would simply note that when you ask someone to transfer assets, you're either planning to steal them or you're trying to help that person to commit fraud against the government, or both. The way this language reads, you can't require a veteran or a family member of the veteran to transfer assets to the agent or an attorney in exchange for the agent and attorney filing a claim. It doesn't refer to third parties who you could retransfer the assets to instead. It's certainly better than nothing, but I don't think it really covers the problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Colby? Aye. Representative Wingert?
Was my name called?
I'm an aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Excused.
Co-Chair Hines?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. House Bill 3661 passes, and let's see, Representative Matthews, I think, be the carrier on that. We're going to close a work session on House Bill 3661, and let's see,
I don't see Roger.
Victoria, did you have any success with the...
I gave him the note.
Okay, so he's coming. Okay.
He was testifying. You can go to this legislative draft if you want.
Okay.
If you want to use some time.
Let's open that up then for... Mr. Denver, do you want to...
You want to open a work session on possible intersections committee measures?
You're going to open up a possible work session on...
Work session.
Pardon me?
It's a work session.
Yeah, work session on LC 4180.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you have under possible introduction of committee measures, you have consideration of legislative draft 4180. It's dated May 12th. This is a draft that allows students to attend school in school district where the student does not have legal residence if the student receives written consent from the district where the school is located. The title of the bill is relating to residency of students.
Yes. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I know that it is time for me to make my caveat about showing support or opposition to any bill, committee bill. This vote would not signify it. However, I have a strong objection to any bills being introduced this late in the session that do not have some reason that is related to time sensitivity, and I will vote against the introduction of this bill based on that.
Okay, thank you. Chair Hunt?
Well, I don't know the source from which it came nor the time sensitivity, but I would move introduction of LC 4180 to 512-11 as a committee bill.
Chair Hunt moves LC 4180, dated 5/12/11, as committee bill. Is there any? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I am the originator of this LC draft. It is a bill that received a hearing thoroughly in the Senate Education Committee, and due to time, did not make it out of that process in time. And I'm reintroducing it so that it can remain viable for discussion here in the last few weeks.
Okay. Is there any further objection?
So, you can, or you can just we can note the objections if you
want. Okay, note the objection and close a.
Are we going to vote on an introduction?
He was just noting your objection.
You can call a roll.
Okay, call a roll, Amy.
I'd like a vote.
Representative Holby?
Aye, though it does not mean I'll support this bill in the future.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
What Representative Holby said. Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Freeman.
Excused.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye. Okay, LC 4180 has been adopted as a committee bill, and we'll close the work session on SC 4180, and we are going to open up. I think, Ron, you're here. We're going to go through your bill really quick here. I'll open up a work session, correction, a public hearing on House Bill 2573.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2573 requires state treasurer investment officers to file statements of economic interest. Your information from your revenue office and your fiscal office, no impact.
Ron?
Thank you, Chair Olson. For the record, my name is Ron Burson, Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And I guess to clarify, this is not my bill. It's a bill that affects my agency that came up. But, as far as House Bill 2573, the agency has no objections to the bill as written. I don't know if we're going to talk about the Dash 2 amendments that were in the back, but I do have concerns about the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I can describe the Dash 2. These exempt from disclosure on a statement of economic interest any expense received by a public official pursuant to a contract entered into by the public body that the official serves, and the value of the expenses are not made available to the public official. It prohibits the Oregon Government Ethics Commission from finding that a public official or employee has violated any government ethics statute or rule if they have acted in good faith in accordance with a rule or policy adopted by the official's agency.
So if you would like to continue on then.
Yes, Chair Olson, I apologize for bringing up the Dash 2, but really the issue I'd like to speak to is this kind of the safe harbor underneath the policies that's mentioned in the Dash 2 amendments, and that subject was actually gone through pretty thoroughly between 2005 and 2007 when the original Senate Bill 10, and I know Representative Berger was part of that group, but it was discussed how do we get safe harbor to these people out there that are acting inside their own policies. And what it was determined was is that the agency or the statewide association would come to the Ethics Commission and ask us to review those policies. The Ethics Commission would do that, look at how they comport with the law out there and the rules, and we would actually vote and give them that safe harbor, and that system has worked. We've had several statewide associations and agencies come to us. Currently, we're working on an agency right now. What this bill does is it spreads that out to all government entities, so instead of the roughly 100 statewide associations and state agencies out there, it would be all government entities, which is roughly about 1,700 government entities. We would also need to go out and look at those policies to prevent any kind of problems from happening. So in other words, instead of them coming to us, asking us for us, now we got to go out to them and find anything. So you say, well, what's the danger in not going out to look? But the Ethics Commission, on a pretty consistent basis, has groups come before us that have set policies that are actually do not comport with ethics laws. And an example, we had a water district come before us where they set a policy where the board members got free water. And, you know, it was in an area that water is pretty valuable in that area. And so, you know, that's obviously a way of enriching yourself, and that is against the ethics statutes. We've had policies out of different organizations where they don't have to be on travel status to be able to receive free meals. The agency will actually pay for the meals, and this is something that the agency has looked at. So if we don't look at this, there could be policies out there that really don't comport with law. And the fiscal impact that we put in on this bill was just for 2573, just adding the 13 investment officers to the roughly 5,300. You know, statement of economic interest filers, we thought there really wasn't a fiscal impact because we're adding 13 people to 5,300. I can't really put much of a dollar figure on that, but when you start looking at this, the agency, which is only 8 people, are going to have to look at a lot of policies out there and bring a lot to the commission. So that's the concern that I have at this point, that there would be a large fiscal impact on my agency to kind of switch the onus around on us to find the problems and policies instead of the agencies bringing those policies to us.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Ron. Who within the Treasurer's office currently files SCI? Do you know? I'm putting you on the spot, but
I think I do know that.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Chair Olson, Representative Berger. Currently, right now, it is the Chief Investment Officer and the Treasurer and the Deputy Treasurer that file statements of economic interest.
So this would add just the 13?
I believe there's 13 investment officers. I don't have that number exactly, but that's the number that we have been using, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Hunt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding, and it would have been since this bill, because this bill was pre-session filed, but my memory was that the state treasurer, sometime in the last 2 or 3 months, has actually required that, I thought it was all of the investment officers, investment advisors, whatever the right term is, required them by his own unilateral action, required them to complete SEIs. Am I right on that?
Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, my understanding is yes, that he did require that. I don't know. I did not look before I came in here today to see if they have filed those SEIs, but he had announced publicly that he would voluntarily have them file statements of economic interest. So,
if I could continue to follow up, and is my understanding right that occurred, that the introduction of this bill occurred prior to his action requiring those SEI filings?
Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, I don't know when the origination of this bill was. There actually was a Senate bill that mirrored this bill, Senate Bill 269, which required the same thing, and I know that was discussed in Senate rules early in the session. So I don't know if they were filed on both sides pre-session or not. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Anyone from the audience like to speak to this bill? Okay, seeing that we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2573, and we are going to open a public hearing on 3660.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senate, this is House Bill 3660. It prohibits the Water Resources Department from regulating or charging a fee for a dam that is part of a confined animal feeding operation water control facility. It declares an emergency. You have from your revenue office no revenue impact, and from your fiscal office a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, so I'm not seeing Roger Beyer here yet. So, Phil, do you want to come up and just share how things are going?
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, for the record, Phil Ward with the Department of Water Resources. As I've had the opportunity to visit with many of you over the last week, you'll understand the department has had significant concern relative to this legislation. We've been in discussions with the dairy industry and the Department of Agriculture about what we believe is a very workable solution to this situation. The dairy industry, the situation is that we need to be able to have our authorities in place to address dam safety issues with these lagoons, which can have a significant impact if they fail. Now, to the credit of the dairy industry in Oregon, we haven't had a major catastrophic animal waste lagoon failure, but you'll note on the testimony that we have had in other parts of the nation and to our neighbor of the north, Washington, some significant issues in the past. What the dairy industry seems, the root of their concern seems to be the fact that we're charging a fee for this activity. And this was a fee instituted in 2009 by the legislature to replace general fund that was removed from this program. What I have tentatively, if you all are willing to bless it, what I have tentatively agreed to with the dairy industry in exchange for their support for an agreement between my agency and the Department of Agriculture to train their water quality inspectors that are on these facilities much more regularly than my dam safety people have a chance to get to, in exchange for an agreement, or the dairy industry support for an agreement of that nature, where we can use the confined animal feeding inspectors at ODA as the first eyes on this, then I have expressed a willingness to approach my commission with a rules proposal to set aside the fee for these particular operations, again, in exchange for that support of an agreement between us and the Department of Agriculture. Director Kova at the Department of Agriculture has wholeheartedly agreed that this would be a good thing to do, that because her people are on the ground much more than mine are able to get there, that they can be trained to spot some of the early warning signals that we look for and give our engineers an alert so we can get an engineer perhaps earlier in the situation than we would have. Our rotation on these type of facilities is 5 to 7 years. And so if we have a confined animal feeding inspector that's out there once or twice a year, it would provide us a more efficient way to ensure the safety of the public in this area.
Okay, thank you. Roger, you want to make your way on up? Phil, I'm curious, how many dairies are we talking about with that would impact this or for your agency?
Mr. Co-Chair, we have currently 22 separate facilities in our inventory that, according to our records, have dams that are higher than 10 feet and that store more than 9.2 acre feet of animal waste. Now, that does not mean that that's all the dairies that have meet those qualifications around the state. To be frank, there are probably some more that we haven't found, but we have 22 in our inventory today.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Cool. Okay, Roger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here, Oregon representative of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. We asked for this bill to be introduced because after last session, the bill that passed, I'm sorry, I don't remember the number of it, but it instituted a fee on dams in Oregon. And in the conversations on that bill as they were going forward, no one ever, Dairy Lagoons was never mentioned. It was always a fee on what everyone thought. I assumed, everyone else assumed, I think, were freshwater impoundments, dams that were created for the purposes of freshwater. After the bill passed, and some of my members, apparently about 22 of them, got letters that saying that they are now being charged an annual fee for inspection of their facilities, I started to get calls wondering why they're getting a fee for something that, for a service they don't get. Because, honestly, none of these people ever remember seeing an inspector on their facilities to inspect this. And besides that, they get inspected at least annually, and most of them twice annually, by CAFO inspectors who are inspecting what they see, the same thing. The CAFO inspector makes sure they're following their management plan for their operation, and in that management plan, they are usually weekly walks around the structure, checking for animal damage, checking for burrowing, checking for structural integrity, making sure that the facility is not overfilled, the same things that the Water Resources Department would be looking for. So when I researched and went back through the rules, I found that it was a 1950-some rule that included dairy lagoons as impoundment structures. We had discussions with Mr. Ward from the Water Resources Department. What he just outlined, we are in complete agreement with it, that we would rather just be exempt from the fees, still subject to the regulation if there are problems, but have the CAFO inspectors, the people who are there on an annual basis, usually twice annually, looking at them, which they are already doing, maybe get a little extra training specifically in what to look for, and report if there are problems. So we are in complete agreement with that solution to this problem. I thank you for holding the hearing today to get the issue in front of out to the public, and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Holvey, you still?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any amendments to this bill that we're looking at?
Don't believe.
Staff knows of no amendments. Thank you. Then I have a question, because you just mentioned regulations by the Water Resources Department. I'm curious what kind of regulation the Water Resources Department has in this area of dams, and why would this bill exempt the department from any regulation?
So, Mr. Chair, I can take a stab at the first part of that, if you so please. Representative, our department has been charged, actually, I believe since the inception of the Oregon Water Code in 1909, with dam safety as a part of our core mission. And so right now the statutory definition, this is a definition by law in Oregon, that any dam that is taller than 10 feet and stores more than 9.2 acre feet of liquid is subject to regulation by our agency. That's why it's caught a number of these larger dairies. We do believe that there are significant dam safety issues relative to dairies around the country. And you'll note on the second page of my testimony, it outlines a number of notable dam failures for animal waste lagoons from around the country. To the credit of Oregon's dairy industry, we have not experienced such a failure. But we do believe it's extremely important that the ability of my department to regulate these facilities for dam safety remain intact. We believe this is extremely important. And I've provided a record dating back well over a decade of different inspections and work we've done with dairies relative to these kind of facilities. One of the areas that we've chosen to work with dairies in Oregon has been on the plan review and approval for these facilities before the lagoons are ever built. And so the dairymen may not even be aware of the work we've done back and forth with their engineers to ensure that these dams are built in a manner that protects life and property from these kind of catastrophic failures. So, Representative, that I think is kind of a bit of our history relative to dam safety and these type of operations.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So I'm still trying to get at under Section 3, Subsection 5 of the bill, basically says, notwithstanding these statutes, which may be, I guess, a partial answer to my question, but why would this bill say that
that these dams are any wire, are they're exempt from regulation by your department, any regulation by your department. So it doesn't sound like you'd be supportive of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are not. We have deep concerns relative to this bill, should it pass in the manner in which it's presented to you today. Because you are correct, Representative, it would indeed eliminate the ability of our department to regulate these facilities for dam safety, plus it would eliminate our ability to regulate the distribution of water from these facilities under Oregon's Water Code. Again, a body of law that has been in place since 1909 in Oregon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? I guess there's a couple things, and the exemption from regulation of construction for maintenance, we're not opposed to having the Water Resource Department still maintain regulation of our facilities. But I think it's important the committee recognize that Oregon's CAFL program is one of a kind in the nation. All dairies in this state have to have a CAFL license. We are the only state in the nation like that. All of these facilities have to be pre-engineered, have to be built to NRCS standards. So our CAFL program that our dairy farmers, and with the passage, if it passes, which we and the dairy farmers support, with the passage of Senate Bill 120, which is a fee increase on these CAFOs, this is a one-of-a-kind program that our dairy farmers are willing to pay more to keep in place. That is a key difference between Oregon and every other state in the nation on the regulation of dairy farms and the lagoons. And to use the term water for the material that's in these lagoons is being very generous, I might add.
Okay. So I just appreciate the document that you sent us, and I really appreciate the photo on the second page. I mean, I'm trying to get a handle on this really quick. I get the 10-feet high dam. And store at least 9.2 acres feet of water. And this one photo that you have here from Washington, shows 1.3 million gallons of waste. I'm not crunching the numbers on that, but what would that equate to 9.2 acres?
So, Mr. Chair, that would far exceed our minimum requirements for a dam. An acre foot of water is water that covers an acre 1 foot deep. And so nine of those with a 10-foot high dam is our base responsibility. The reality is that many of these facilities are much larger than that today. That's just our statutory minimum in the state of Oregon that kicks a dam into our jurisdiction.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, next up, Peggy Lynch, Jim Myron, and Sue Marshall. Hello, Peggy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch. I'm with the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And usually the Rules Committee sees another of our volunteers here to talk about governance issues. But just in case your members don't realize, we do have volunteers who follow human service issues and public safety issues, and in this case, natural resource issues. And so I'm here before you today to share that the League has spent the last 3 years studying water quality and water quantity issues and adopted new positions related to assuring that we have abundant clean water for today and in the future. We've also been involved in fee issues as we have had to struggle over the few years related to revenue in this state. But we do believe that with fees and regulation, that since the regulations protect both the public and the business, that there ought to be a 50-50 split. So we're very concerned that we're seeing fees actually not happening here this session that would at least acknowledge that and continue to make sure that we have those regulations happening. So as we understand it, House Bill 3660 would eliminate a small annual fee for inspecting the wastewater control facilities, and you have the wonderful pictures that you have seen from the Water Resources Department. So although the fee issue, $75 and 22 facilities that we know of, is not significant, more important to us is that the dams at those facilities are inspected to assure that the public protection from failure. These facilities are located in a variety of places where failure could affect local streams, public roads, or other public or private property. The state has an obligation to regulate and inspect these dams on behalf of the general public as well as those businesses. However, we have continued to work with natural resource agencies to try to figure out most efficiencies. And we appreciate what has been shared today related to the Department of Ag and Water Resources. We would note that cross-training costs money. And if we're going to have a cross-training and a cross-checking between the CAFO regulators and inspectors from the Department of Ag and Water Resources, that there will have to be some sort of funding mechanism to make sure that that happens. But most important is that the inspection be done by someone with the expertise to see the potential failures. And that, to us, is the critical part of this. Our testimony has been or will be emailed to you in the future, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name's Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Tualatin and Riverkeepers and the Willamette Riverkeeper. We're opposed to House Bill 3660 as it's currently written. Our primary concern relates to removal of the regulatory authority of the Department of Water Resources. Failure of these structures can have catastrophic effects on water quality. We think that $75 is really a very modest amount to ensure protection both for those landowners, operators, and for the public. So if there is a collaborative agreement that's being worked out between the departments, that means more eyes strategically placed on these structures, that may be a good thing. But ultimately, Water Resources Department has the expertise and historic role here, and we'd like to see that continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Co-Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Meyer, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. And let me just say that we are opposed to the bill on the basis that it takes away statutory regulatory authority from the Water Resources Department. We do support, however, the idea that these agencies should work together to have a more efficient and effective program. So if that means that the $75 fee for these facilities needs to go away, that doesn't give us any heartburn. But as long as the Water Resources Department maintains the statutory authority and the two agencies work together to cooperate to solve the problem, we think that's a good solution. Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members, any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify regarding this bill? Okay. Going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3660. And I greatly appreciate both parties really working on this bill, too. Thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 3317A.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3317A. It modifies provisions regulating communities governed by declarations. So you may recall this from the floor. This was sent to the Committee on Rules. I hate to characterize it myself, but I will. There was objections to the prohibition of recording of meetings of these boards. You have the -A3 amendment from Representative Wingard that deletes those provisions. It deletes the provisions authorizing the Board of Directors to restrict or prohibit recording of meetings. That's the only change to it.
So do we need to adopt?
You want to invite up Scott Berry.
Okay.
Explanation of it.
Scott, you want to come up and give an explanation?
You just need to adopt the -A3s. Yes, okay. That's what you want to do.
Good afternoon, committee. Scott Berry, representing the Community Association Institute, the Condominium HOA Working Group, and the Oregon Washington Community Association managers. In front of you would be the dash A3s to House Bill 3317, which take care of the concerns that were addressed on the floor. And it takes care of them in two different sections, identical language in those two sections, which are sections 3 and sections 12, removing that language. And with me today is Rich Vail with Vail Fotheringham, who's got over 30 years of experience in this area, to answer any technical questions and give you a very quick synopsis of the bill.
Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, I am a volunteer. I am a member of the Community Associations Institute and on the condominium working group for the last 30 years. Our law firm is actually Vail Fotheringham. Scott's doing really well other than the pronunciation.
Thank you.
We represent about half of the homeowner associations in Oregon, about 10,000 associations total in Oregon, and about 50,000 residents of Oregon are serving on a homeowners association board at any given time. Many of the things that come before us every couple of years, every session, are driven by those volunteers who serve on their homeowner association boards of directors. And this bill contains those kinds of provisions. For example, a provision that in the declaration and bylaws often says if there's a vacancy on the board, then the board appoints the successor to the vacancy, really kind of runs afoul of the fact that many times that vacancy is created by a recall. And if the owners recall and the board continues to appoint the successor, it tends to promote a board that is self-perpetuating. We do have a number of owners that often are vocal in this kind of a circumstance. And so, for example, this bill does deal with the fact that if a vacancy occurs as a result of a recall, then the appointment of a new member of the board is also subject to owner vote, and regardless of what the declaration bylaw says, does not default back to the board appointing the member of the vacancy. The provision that's been removed was also driven by some of these 50,000 volunteer members of boards of directors who are frankly sick and tired of seeing YouTube videos of the discussions that they have as volunteers in these board meetings. We are fully in support of removing those at this particular time. We put them in there at the request of a number of these members who serve, or these residents who serve on boards of directors. But as Mr. Gibbon, who's in the back here, who's a lawyer that specializes in representing the owners in disputes with their homeowner association, will tell you, there are frequently times when some sort of policing by the owners themselves may appropriately mean that there is a recording made of that activity or that meeting. So we are in support of the bill as it is. It is, as we get every session, it's got a lot of girth to it. We apologize for that. Because we have both a condominium and a planned community statute, everything we do has to be stated twice. And so you've got double provisions throughout the bill. That doesn't mean that there's a lot to it. It simply means that we've got to cover those things in a couple of times. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Wingert.
I have a question just to thank you, somebody who was the president of his homeowners association at one time, so basically understands this volunteer service, and it felt like volunteer service. I appreciate the removal of that because I do think there's an accountability piece. It comes with the lack of compensation, that, you know, when you have power over other people, that there's an ability for that to be very public. And I think the rest of the bill should probably have no problem, and I look forward to its passage on the House floor.
Chair Olson, Representative Wingert, I would note that we find more and more all the time our legislators and many of our public servants are coming from their service as volunteers on the board of directors. So we appreciate the fact that this provides an important opportunity for many Oregonians to get some experience in that regard.
Follow-up. Well, then that will get them used to seeing themselves on YouTube from their public meetings.
Chair Hope. Hey, appreciate you bringing this forward. I voted for the original version of the bill. I was surprised it failed on the floor, frankly. Give us your assessment of the of the provision that this amendment would pull out. I mean, how critical to you all was that in terms of the whole scope? Obviously, this bill makes lots and lots of changes. Is that a piece that we're going to need to come back to in the subsequent session, or was that a very low priority item as you looked at all these changes?
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, the idea that we are going to be subjected to a public face when we serve as a volunteer on a homeowners association board is one that we've got to get used to. Clearly, it's reflected in the fact that we have an open meetings requirement in both the condominium and the Planning Community Act. However, it is difficult because many of these volunteers, this is the first time they've ever experienced any kind of public service, and they're not prepared for it. I do think that eventually we will come back to the legislature with a provision that asks at least let's not have the recording be admissible in court in a lawsuit. Let's have it be, if in fact there is not some kind of disclosure at the beginning that a recording is going to take place. We have that for many other provisions in business. Telephone recordings, for example, cannot be admitted unless there's a disclosure that's taking place. What we have is folks coming into HOA meetings with a tape recorder in their pocket, and then the next thing you know, that's out on the internet or whatever. So eventually we probably will tweak this somewhat and look at how to make it work. But I suspect strongly that the message that's been sent by the vote that took place on the floor just a few days ago has been heard by not only those who are volunteering and doing the legislative activity, but members of the boards themselves. The word's gotten out, and we've actually had several meetings training board members where we've discussed this, and they've hung their heads and said, yeah, you're probably right. If we're going to do it, I guess we got to be prepared to be recorded. So someone comes in and says, I'm going to record, at least you know you're going to be recorded, and then it would be admissible, for example.
Thanks. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments on this, being one that supports the original version of the bill as well. And I just wanted to kind of go back a little bit as to the difference between these board of director meetings and the General Homeowner Association meeting, where people do attend and record, and there's no restrictions. And so, if I recall, there was a lot of discussion around the decisions made in these board of director meetings, and those decisions are required to have minutes, and those decisions are, and those minutes are disclosable and available to all the members. So really this bill was simply about the actual recording or video recording or tape recording of the conversations that were that the board was having in those types of meetings. And the concern was that this really has a potentially a chilling effect in participation for volunteer board of directors, being subject to having everything they said be admittable in court, whereas it didn't really seem those discussions weren't really the pertinent parts, but the decisions that were being made that affect the association and that were, you know, brought up in the regular homeowner association meetings would be still subject to all the scrutiny of the members. And so I was trying to weigh that, and it seemed like I was paralleling it to we have executive sessions at Link at county commissioners and executive sessions that aren't recorded.
recorded. Ahead of the actual meeting where they allow that disclosure. So I was making that sort of parallel. Can you, because I felt like the association was really making a strong statement that this was negatively impacting their ability to run their associations. And so if in fact you're saying you're getting this out to the board of directors and they're, you know, acknowledging that they're going to be subject to recording everything they say in a discussion to facilitate their thinking, do you see that as really going to be reducing the amount of people willing to step into those positions?
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Vice Chair, or Co-Vice Chair Holby, I'm not getting used to this Cove and Cove.
Neither am I.
Neither are they.
Correct to it.
The reality is that there have been some that have said, if I'm going to be subjected to be recording, I'm not going to serve. Mm. And it is true that homeowner associations have many positions that go unfilled because no one wants to do it. And so, yes, that it will slightly impact that. However, we have also, interestingly, in this bill, clarified something with respect to executive session. And we do have executive session capability. It used to be that it said this, and this. And there were a few owners that came in saying, unless you're talking about all those things, it's not an executive session. We've clarified that it's any one of four items that can be discussed in executive session. That's helpful should this bill pass, because it alleviates one of the problems that we've been dealing with. But I will not blow smoke up your skirt. It's a problem that we are going to have to deal with, and at a minimum, to answer Representative Hunt's question earlier, I think we need to have at least the non-admissibility provisions at some point, and I think you'll see us next session asking for that.
Okay. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, and I appreciate the efforts of bringing this bill back. Apologize for being late. Got a little bit going on. The whole idea of worrying about chilling people's conversation because it may be recorded is an interesting phenomenon. And having served on many local boards and city councils and budget committees and whatnot, I understand the difficulty. But I balance that with the fact that people should be honest when they're talking and not be afraid if what they say is on the front page of a newspaper. And in most situations, I think if people understood what they were saying was being recorded and it, their word would have to mean something, it should make the process better, not worse. So, I appreciate you fixing that part in this bill. I look forward to it rolling out and working well for the homeowners associations that will be bound by this. I think you'll find that people will continue to try to make their communities better and maybe do it in a way that's a little more honest.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been reading through the bill, and I appreciate the warning that everything's run twice because they're obviously dealing with two different kinds of organizations that are quite similar. I've figured out that there are some substantive provisions in the bill. And I apologize, I wasn't on the committee that heard the bill in the first place. So what I understand is that you've changed the way in which board members can be replaced in the event of a recall. And you've changed the way that you have required the mortgagee to act quickly when it's notified about something that it has a veto authority over. The first question I have is, when we're talking about a mortgagee here, are we referring to the mortgagee for an individual unit, or are we talking about somebody that the owners association itself might owe money to? Who are we talking about?
Co-Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart. There are many provisions in condominium declarations that require mortgagee consent by at least 75%, sometimes more than that, before the declaration can be amended. So the owners can't even change their own governing document without mortgagee consent. What this does is essentially say, if the mortgagee ignores it for 60 days,
it's consented.
Consented.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. May I follow up? Are there any other substantive changes? I recognize there's a lot of little drafting changes, but are there any other substantive changes than those two in here?
Yes, there are. Co-Chair Olson, Representative.
If so, what are they?
Well, there are a number, and it would take a fair amount of time to list them all, but I'll give you another example, perhaps in an effort to make sure that we understand what kinds of things are there. Easements over common elements. Oftentimes a utility company, say a cable company or something like that, will come in and need to get an easement over a common element. There's two kinds of common elements, general common elements and limited common elements. Used to be that limited common elements, you couldn't get an easement over limited common element without every owner's consent affected. But if a limited common element like a hallway affects 10 owners, and only 9 of them want to give consent, we didn't want to hold up what would be a good idea because it required 100%. So we moved that to a 75% vote if it's a limited common element that affects 5 or more units. That's an example. Now, most of these are not anywhere near that substantive. Special declarant rights, for example. We're not going to saddle someone who is the successor declarant with all of the liabilities of the declarant unless they take on the responsibilities of that declarant. That's the kind of smaller kind of technical thing that it contains. And there are a number of simply grammatical errors and fixes that were done. So it's housekeeping to a large degree.
Right. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had momentarily forgotten that this thing has been thoroughly vetted by the General Government and Consumer Protection Committee, and that probably covers those other issues quite well. And I apologize for taking the time. Thank you.
Okay.
Are we in, Mr. Chair, are we in work session?
We are in work session.
So I'd move the -A3 amendments to House Bill 3317.
Representative Wingard moves the -3 amendments into House Bill 3317. Is there a discussion? Any objection?
I'll be
so moved.
I'll be objecting to the -3s.
Okay. First one, Amy, would you call the roll for the -3s?
Representative Wingard?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Colby?
No.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. -3 amendments are moved into House Bill 3317.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
I would move House Bill 3317 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wingard moves House Bill 3317A with -3 amendments to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Yeah. Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Wingard.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
House Bill 3317 passes, and who would like to carry that?
Representative
Wingard. Okay, thank you. Close work session on House Bill 3317, and we open up a work session on Senate Bill 331.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Cox is going to be the staff on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 331 requires the Department of Education to grant waivers to allow school districts to contract with entities that meet specified criteria for purpose of administering nationally normed assessments, directs OD to reimburse school districts for costs of assessments that are administered under the waiver, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2001. You have a minimal fiscal statement, no revenue, and if you'll recall, this is the bill we looked at last week, which allows districts to use the ACT's plan assessment for 10th graders as opposed to the College Board's PSAT.
Okay. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wingard moves Senate Bill 331 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, Amy, would you call the roll?
Aye.
Representative
Freeman?
Yes.
Representative
Garrett? Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. Senate Bill 331 passes. Let's see. I think was Representative Carter was interested in doing this, wasn't he?
The last one, probably.
I think it was the last one.
Hey, oh, the last one
tell you what, I'll swap. He can have that one, and I'll take 331. How about that?
That's really great.
Deal?
Because we haven't. Okay.
3317.
Okay. We'll do that then. Okay, we're going to close work session on House Bill 3317, and Rules Committee is adjourned.
Thank you. Hey, Chair.